Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for inviting me back to be with you. It's very nice to be with you all again. This morning, I'm going to share a reading of Lot's wife in this story. So we just read this whole story, but I'm going to focus on the character of Lot's wife and the particular moment in the story when she is transformed into a pillar of salt. So we know, I think, that the story of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah has traditionally been associated with notions of wickedness and divine retribution, with the petrification of Lot's wife serving as a cautionary tale about attachment and disobedience. Her looking back at Sodom is usually read as an expression of her attachment to Sodom and its wicked way of life, and her petrification into a pillar of salt is usually understood as divine punishment because she disobeyed the command. So in the rabbinic literature, she serves to contrast with Lot, who did not look back, and also to generate sympathy for him. So in the Wisdom of Solomon, we read that it's not so much his bereavement that evokes sympathy, but the fact that he did not enjoy wholehearted support from his wife. I could go on. In Christian biblical commentary, it's no kinder to her, as I'm sure you can imagine. She's been called representative of all those in every time who are caught in the consequences of the evil they cannot quite let go. And my personal favourite, a worldly, selfish woman who spent lavishly and entertained elaborately. Her appearance in Genesis 19 constitutes her first and last in the Hebrew Bible. She's given no origin story, no name, and no voice. She doesn't utter a single word. All the Genesis text tells us about her is contained in six Hebrew words, which translate literally, "And his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt." Based on this solitary mention, elaborate character portraits are constructed to justify her demise. She's mentioned once in the New Testament when Luke's Jesus compares the approach of the day the Son of Man is revealed with the approach of both the flood in the days of Noah and the destruction of Sodom in the days of Lot, and warns his listeners to remember Lot's wife. So how do we remember her? I don't think I've ever spoken with anyone, even in passing, about this story who has not expressed some level of discomfort with many aspects of the story, but specifically also with her fate in it. Some ask, if she knew it was dangerous to look back, why would she have risked her life if not for a significant reason? The Midrash tells us that Lot's wife had four daughters, two married and two unmarried, which means she left behind children and possibly grandchildren. According to this tradition, she turned back to see whether they were coming or not. When I first began doing preliminary research for this reading, I searched academic journals and things and got all these hits back, and almost none of them were actually academic articles. The overwhelming majority of them were poems, just pages and pages and pages of search results, all of them poems, all of them titled Lot's Wife with a different author. So I was like, what's going on here? And they were just all poems of people entering imaginatively into the story and trying to understand what was going on. In Christine Beattie's poem, Lot's wife is the one who cooked the meals in Sodom. She writes, "Whoever is God, the bread must still be made. Raised her daughters in Sodom. The Lord may kill the children tomorrow, but today they must be bathed and fed. And visited her neighbors in Sodom. Well and good to condemn your neighbor's religion, but weren't they there when the baby was born and when the well collapsed?" She continues, "While her husband communes with God, she tucks the children into bed. In the morning, when he tells her of the judgment, she puts down the lamp she is cleaning. She runs for a moment to say goodbye to the herd. She smiles blindly to the woman who held her hand at childbed. It is easy for eyes that have always turned to heaven not to look back. Those that have been, by necessity, drawn to earth cannot forget that life is lived from day to day. On the breast of the hill, she chooses to be human and turns in farewell and never regrets the sacrifice. The idea that the self develops detached from and in opposition to others is a core part of the mythological, psychological, and political bases of patriarchy. Western Christianity has long lauded the Abrahamic model of God encounter through interpersonal detachment. Leave your home, leave your family, slaughter your son. Against this separative notion of self is the feminist affirmation of the communal character of selfhood. I want to suggest that Lot's wife might offer us an embodiment, an example of this. When instructed to look away from the destruction of the city where she has made her home, nurtured relationships of mutual reciprocity, raised her children, and where, according to at least one Midrashic tradition, two of her daughters now perish, along with possible grandchildren, she chooses to look back. She displays her allegiance to her community and to interdependence over and against the abstract ethic of obedience to a static command. So at this point, one might raise the obvious objection. This is all well and good, but Sodom is evil in its totality. The poet's neighborly, child-rearing, family-nurturing women, these are fictions invented against the plain sense of the text, to which I respond that this text is not quite so simple. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah and the condemnation of Lot's wife are usually justified on the grounds of Sodom's total wickedness. In Genesis 18, in the previous chapter, Abraham and Yahweh have entered into a negotiation that ends when Yahweh agrees to spare Sodom if 10 righteous can be found in the city. Since he goes on to destroy Sodom, we assume that 10 righteous could not be found. The text itself does not give much help in determining who is wicked in these cities and what the precise nature of their wickedness is. Other biblical references and allusions to Sodom and Gomorrah don't provide much clarity either. It might come as a little bit of a surprise, but the sin of Sodom throughout the Hebrew Bible is variously identified as or likened to social oppression, adultery, dishonesty, and strengthening the hands of evildoers, arrogance, gluttony, indifference towards the poor and needy, doing taboo, idolatry and abandoning the covenant, and wickedness, violence, and injustice. In Genesis 18, Yahweh speaks of the myriad cry of distress of Sodom and Gomorrah and of their exceedingly grievous sin. Many English translations will say the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, the outcry against them is so great, but that's not what it says. In the Hebrew, it's very clearly the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah. So are all the people of Sodom and Gomorrah at the same time and in equal measure oppressed and oppressors deserving of destruction? Neither the narrator nor Yahweh makes any attempt to clarify the matter. Their cry of distress remains, disturbing the notion of total depravity. Perhaps Lot's offer of his daughters to the mob may provide sufficient clue as to the identity of at least some of Sodom's oppressed, whose cries have reached heaven. How many daughters have already been raped? Are all of Sodom's inhabitants such by choice? Biblical scholar David Gunn writes, "Now we have another way of reading this story, for the excluded are beginning to appear and the included are beginning to look different. Turn back to the crowd gathered around the house and read again. The men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man surrounded the house." In fact, the word used for people is routinely used of men to the exclusion of women. So, for example, we quite often will have all of the people and their wives. So for that reason, I think a better translation, or at least an alternative translation, is probably "all the men to the last man." These are clearly the men of the city. So where are the women? Where are the children, the young daughters and sons? Where are the babies? Where are all these in this facile talk of the righteous and the wicked? Patriarchy blinds us to their presence in the story and to the horror of their destruction. Consider Gordon Wenham's remark. This is quite a well-known biblical scholar, and he says, "There are no righteous in Sodom except Lot, who will leave. So there is no question of divine injustice in the overthrow of Sodom." When the male subjectivity is allowed to dominate the text to the exclusion of all others, interpreters accept the notion of the total wickedness of Sodom and the justice of its total destruction. The men of Sodom are wicked, therefore Sodom is wicked. All the male inhabitants participated, therefore all of the inhabitants participated. The text, however, by emphasizing the men of Sodom in quite a striking way, raises questions about the presence and complicity of others in Sodom. Their absence, in fact, alerts us to their presence because we are not told about them. We begin to wonder about them. By drawing attention to these others of Sodom and by emphasizing the wickedness of the men of Sodom, the text arguably excludes these others from the wickedness of Sodom. Does that make sense? Yeah. By drawing attention to these others, women, children, babies, livestock, vegetables, by drawing attention to these others of Sodom and by emphasizing the wickedness of the men of Sodom, the text arguably excludes these others from the wickedness of Sodom. So let's think for a moment about this pillar of salt. While the transformation of Lot's wife has traditionally been read as divine punishment, the narrator is not at all specific about the agency by which she becomes a pillar of salt. Given the emphatic way in which the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah is ascribed to Yahweh, Yahweh rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah sulfurous fire from Yahweh out of heaven. It's noteworthy that the narrator doesn't then signal divine responsibility for Lot's wife's transformation. She simply becomes a pillar, not of stone, as we might expect, but of salt, which is unusual. And so let's think about how salt might make a difference here. In the ancient world, salt was a necessity of life, used as a seasoning, a preservative, a disinfectant, a component of ceremonial offerings, and as a unit of exchange. The Hebrew Bible contains numerous references to salt in various contexts. It's used metaphorically to signify permanence, loyalty, durability, fidelity, usefulness, value, and purification. Salt is a sign of table fellowship. Salt wards off corruption. Newborn babies were rubbed with salt to indicate that the child would be raised to have integrity. And salt is markedly connected with the covenant, so much so that it has been suggested to symbolize the covenant itself. In the New Testament, I'm sure you're familiar, Matthew's Jesus calls his disciples the salt of the earth. Salt carried all of these aforementioned connotations, particularly within Matthew's tradition. So being the salt of the earth is taken here as a metaphor for exercising a beneficial influence on the world, particularly through intimate, hands-on involvement with the everyday life of the earth and its inhabitants. So my suggestion is that the text does not punish, but rather preserves Lot's wife. She does not become a negative sign, an object of cursing, but rather a positive sign, an object of blessing. Having lived a life of intimate involvement and vital necessity, a life of women's work, if you will, she stands as a monument which cries out in distress to heaven, because salt is also tears, anguish for the women and children of Sodom. Perhaps she offers us a model of response to the divine violence of the text. Yahweh rained sulfurous fire upon several communities, destroying all the inhabitants, right down, we are told, to the vegetation. He spares just four members of one family, and these he instructs to look away. Three of the four apparently find themselves capable of obedience, and the vast majority of interpreters have nodded their assent. Perhaps this is because the vast majority of interpreters have found within themselves the same capability. We might want to ask ourselves how often we have been comfortable looking away from the divine violence of our scriptures. How often we felt comfortable looking away from the violence our theological constructs and conceptions of God do to those they exclude and other. In refusing to look away from the suffering of those others with whom she has shared her life, surely hers is the kind of presence upon the earth that renders it better than it was before. Surely she is the salt of the earth. In returning to Jesus' warning in Luke to remember Lot's wife, I want to draw your attention to the sentence that immediately follows. It's a familiar one. He says, "Whoever tries to keep their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life will preserve it." Indeed, the life of Lot's wife is simultaneously lost and preserved in the solitary moment of agency the text allows her. Lot's wife is unreservedly condemned by generations of biblical interpreters, yet she is the character in the story who, eschewing self-preservation, is preserved by the text on that hillside of horror as a monument to neighbor love, a memorial to shared suffering, and a witness to covenant hope. And I'll just finish with this poem by Russian poet Anna, I always want to say Akhmatova, but that's not right. Akhmatova, there you go. Thank you. She writes, "The righteous man..." Would you want to read this? Yeah, you come up here and read it.
"The righteous man then trailed Jehovah's guide, hulking and bright across a ridge of black. But in his wife a keening anguish cried, 'It's not too late. You can look back upon your Sodom's old red towers, the square where once you sang, the garden where you wove, the emptied windows of the house where you bore your children by your husband's love.' She turned and looked, the bitter vision blurred, welding her eyelids shut with mortal pain. Into transparent salt her body turned, as each quick foot took root into the plain. Who will weep for such a woman, for so small a loss in such a brutish circumstance? Yet ever in my heart I will recall that wife who gave her life for a glance."
Thanks. And that's the reading. Questions, comments, thoughts?
Just about the asking the people to look away. I'm thinking about the moment of Moses' intercession on top of the mountain when God tells him to leave him alone, to go away, and Moses doesn't. And that's the necessity, that's the person we need. And also that, like, when God does these things, it hurts him as well. He doesn't want you to see. Like, it's painful for everybody involved. But yeah, that act of the intercessor, of bearing witness, mm-hmm. and refusing to turn away.
Yeah. The importance of bearing witness, and that almost as an act of defiance at times.
Okay, here's an alternative reading of it, and the only way I can get around this story. And I don't know whether there's any geological or theological evidence for this, but Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by a volcano. The reason that the backstory about the people being so evil is because the only way people can get their heads around why so many people were destroyed. The reason that Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt because she was slower than the rest of the family and couldn't keep up, and they left him behind. Now, I don't know that actually there's any evidence there's a volcano anywhere near Sodom and Gomorrah, but the idea that a cataclysm like that has to have some kind of an explanation, and therefore you have to make the people evil in order to justify it, makes sense to me that that's how this story is there.
Yeah. The So as far as the story of Sodom and Gomorrah goes, it's I mean, you know that we get in the book of Judges a very similar story, right? You've spoken about that just recently. You have a story that basically is a crisis of hospitality. Very, very important to take care of and support and make sure the needs of foreigners and strangers and aliens in the land are met, and failure to do so, like the most abhorrent, a very, very bad thing to do. So yeah, it's a kind of a folk tale, a story that existed, and then, like you say, why did they meet the fate that they met? Here's this story, crisis of hospitality, and so they sort of find their way together. Yeah, if you want to think about the was Sodom a historical place, and was there some kind of cataclysm that happened, and then so they're just, you know, and I mean the idea that everyone basically was reduced to salt, and she simply shared in their fate because of proximity. Yeah, there are so many ways to read this story and think about it, and that is certainly one of them. If we're wanting to kind of think about historic, but if we want to do more with it, I think, because if we think what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah, then it's okay, this is probably what happened, and then that's kind of the end of the conversation. Whereas if we want to think about the story as a sacred story that communities continue to interact with and return to and engage and find new levels of meaning in that can then influence the way that they live in the world, then I think we ask more questions of the story. It's hard on historians. Sure. It was what was the author's intention? Why has the author included this story here in this particular book? What were they trying to communicate? What kind of meaning did they want to convey? Is that a fair?
Yeah, I guess.
This is the story that we have. Yeah. So when it comes, when we think about meaning and how we derive meaning from a text or a story or what have you, thinking about the author's intention is one such way that we derive meaning from a story. There are other ways. The people who maintained the text.
It wasn't just written by someone, mm-hmm. but the community decided it was worthwhile.
Absolutely.
For over thousands of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A community decided it was worthwhile to maintain the story, and that's why we have this tradition, right, to continue to interact with. I guess, yeah, considerations about authorial intent are valid considerations. What I'm presenting is more of a text-based reading, where rather than I'm not particularly interested in the author's intention. That's not really what I'm trying to unearth, but rather possibilities that are embedded within the rhetoric and aesthetics of the text. Does that make sense? And those are really infinite, just about. But there are some that the text kind of seems to want to nudge you in the direction of. Yeah.
I was just curious to know what you think of the fact that Lot's wife doesn't get a name, and the etymology of Lot is covering veil. I wonder if that's a hint. And the other question was, I don't believe in a God that punishes evil with evil. These people did. Does our God reflect more about us than actually the beyondness and the mystery of a presence that created the earth almost 4 billion years before human beings arrived on the scene, and a lot longer before religion turned up? What do you think about the fact that we have a God of retribution in this story?
Yeah. So when we, as Elkin was saying, we inherit these traditions, right? And we inherit them. They have, the origins are really quite mysterious. We inherit these traditions. They come down to us. They have funneled through generations, generations, generations of political and social and cultural interests of different groups, all of this. So when we inherit this text that is deeply problematic in its portrayal of God and God's interaction with human communities, we can consider, historical considerations like this is what they believed. They had this, theological construct of divine retribution, blah, blah, blah. And then, again, I think the conversation comes to an end. It's because then what do we do with this text? What do we do with this story? And then so what I'm advocating for, I suppose, in this reading is a textual analysis. What are the possibilities inherent in this text, and how can we find value in it? If we want to maintain this tradition, if we want to find meaning in it and have it be something that is valuable and, contributes to a moral vision for how we live our lives, then how can we treat this text? What can we find within it that is going to be useful and valued, given that it is so deeply problematic?
Lack of a name for Lot's Wife?
It's not unusual.
Tell me what you feel about it.
What I feel about it? She's given, so in some of the rabbinical traditions, they give her a name. I think they call her Judith or Edith. I can't remember. They add in. Okay. Yeah. So perhaps that's significant. She doesn't, like I said, she doesn't have an origin story. She doesn't have a name. She doesn't have a voice. She doesn't say a word. We first encounter her by inference, I think, when Lot is said to prepare a meal for the visitors. No, he didn't. just like in the previous chapter, Abraham is said to have prepared a meal for the visitors, but we're also told that it was Sarah and her servant, I think, who prepared the meal. Baked the bread, did the dishes, all of that. So I think in the same way, we can probably assume that in this chapter, it's Lot's wife who does those things. So we first encounter her only by inference. And then the next time that we encounter her is when they're seized and removed from Sodom by the messengers. And even the instruction to flee, the English translation says, what it says. But it's all delivered in the masculine singular. Flee for your masculine singular life. Do not look behind you, masculine singular, because of the Lord's mercy on him, Lot. So, did she hear the command? Was it addressed to her? These are the questions that male commentators for many years have not really asked. Bevan?
Earlier on you said Lot's wife was a worldly, selfish woman. I think that's what I heard you say. Is there any reference to that?
Oh, no. That was me giving an example of how outlandish Christian biblical commentary can be. So it's just an example of something that has been said about her within Christian biblical commentary, how cruel they have been to her and how they've constructed these elaborate character portraits based on just the six Hebrew words that we have to work with. So that's certainly not what I'm saying about her. That's something that a commentator has said about her. No, there's really nothing in the text to suggest any of those things.
Thank you very much, Nika. It's great to have us thinking, hearing different perspectives, different ways of looking at stories and getting us to talk about it. And I'm sure, and are you staying for morning tea? Mm. So there's more opportunity to discuss with Nika over morning tea. If anyone